Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction again to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. White Rabbit history is one big mystery. That's about all yours truly has come to conclusion on in the past 10 years, especially in the past, let's say, five. And this is in 2009, you know, June 2009. The last 5 years, you know, my mind's been blown wide open, especially coming about 5 years ago. But let's go back to the American Revolution, because I already talked about that. American Revolution, some say, was against some bankers out of Europe, against the oppressive debt, against George III. Some say all the above. Some just say George III. But we have an interesting historical revisionist. And historical revisionism is very important for every history, for every history in the world, especially when it comes to European history or in the history of the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, because we don't know anything. No, we're clueless, and everyone, you know, when the internet came out, we got a glimpse at how clueless we were. Yeah, because the first thing that was huge was all this revisionist history. And most of you are familiar with one branch, that's Holocaust. It's stuff geared toward the World War II, and I'm going to get to that in a few. But that is the tip of the iceberg in World War II history. Yeah, that type of revisionism is a tip of the iceberg. That is stuff that gets a lot of public play, but I'm going to point you to some stuff that has blown some minds, even at the upper hierarchies of things. But anyways, going back to the American Revolution, you got revolution against George III and some bankers, and they kicked him out of there. But Andrew Hamilton brought out this First Bank of the U.S., and First Bank of the U.S. was basically a bank paying back George III interest on loans or whatever. You know, I guess they couldn't get out of paying him all the money, or you know, someone left a foot in the door or whatever. But that First Bank of the U.S. was there, and there was a tie to the Bank of England. So they didn't fully kick these bankers out of there. No, they didn't. And Eustace Mullins, that's Eustace Mullins, is a historical revisionist that brought out that book ages ago called The New World Order, talking about all this stuff, talking about these banksters, these bankers. And he was a student of Ezra Pound, the famous poet Ezra Pound, and he started looking into this, and he went over this. And actually, you can get online, you can probably find him on Google or YouTube, and you can actually probably watch him for a while. And he's a great historical revisionist when it comes down to these bankers and how far stuff goes back, the tip of the iceberg. As you say, you know, when you start digging into this stuff. But anyways, they brought out this First Bank of the U.S., and that was Alexander Hamilton, and that was tied to the Bank of England. Well, that charter was revoked by Jefferson. Yeah, that Thomas Jefferson didn't so much like that, so when he came into power, he revoked that charter. And that charter came up for renewal, and he says, well, I don't like this Bank of England over these ties of the Bank of England, and we don't need any of these bankers here. We kicked most of them out of here from Europe. We don't need these ones out of London, so we're just going to kick them out of there. You know, they were all tied to the Rothschild in one way, shape, manner, or form. But then a year later, you end up in the War of 1812. Now, if you read your history books, you think the War of 1812 was about, you know, the British grabbing sailors, and it was a naval war, and you know, there's all this, all this garbage of War of 1812. The War of 1812 happened because England, Great Britain, was trying to punish this colony, United States, for not only kicking them out of there, but for refusing their banking, for not keeping their First Bank of the U.S. in there, which had ties to the Bank of England. You know, they were trying to punish them for that, and they of course lost that. So then you come forward to to a Rothschild agent that got his foot in the door, and they started the second bank of the U.S. Yeah, how did that happen? I don't know. You know, Eustace Mullins talks about this stuff, but someone got their foot in the door and had the second bank of the U.S. And the second bank of the U.S. was chartered, and it came in. It came in under a little different auspices. It was, but it was still someone connected to one of the other Rothschilds out of Paris. And the second bank of the U.S. came in, and of course it stayed in until Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson came in and he gave the famous speech that he was going to root out the bankers because they're a brood of vipers or a nest of vipers. You know, he sounds like a Jesus or something. You know, a generation of vipers in there, and he basically kicked it out or basically suspended all their deposits or took all the money out of that bank, and that was 1836. And then in 1837, of course, you have the big collapse of 1837, and when he removed all the deposits, one of the Rothschild agents or whatever made it impossible for America to operate internationally, and that ended up in the big banking crisis of 1837, and that's when the Rothschilds came in after that and bought everything for pennies on the dollars, and shortly thereafter, fortunes were in the middle of Morgan's fortune was started, and all these big American fortunes were started after that. But that is a brief overview, and Eustace Mullins has been critical to getting into how this came about and stuff like that. And it is quite an education because you're not going to get it in the textbooks, are you? No. But that's just tip of the iceberg. So when I say they kicked a bunch of bankers out of here, well, they didn't kick them all out of here, and we still got them to this day. And sure, you think the Federal Reserve isn't tied to all that? Yeah, it is. There's a new book coming out. I mentioned Joseph P. Farrell. I'm going to go into him a little bit more because, you know, I just found out something just a day ago that he is bringing out a book called Banksters from Here to Babylon, and he traces their origins back to the temples of Babylon. The temples of Babylon, they used to use priests for trade. In other words, the priests were very respected, and they would go to another part of the colony with these little tablets, these little orders, and they would trade wheat, corn, whatever, and that's how they instigated trade. And they would have currency, and the currency was state-sponsored, maybe a little clay piece of currency. But this crew got it started there, and it should be an interesting read to what he comes up with. It's going to be fascinating because I know their calendar goes back to Babylon. Sure. Now you might think it's your average Hebrew, your local rabbi. Most likely isn't. It may be your local Protestant minister attached to these. Yeah, they're attached to fraternities or whatever. But it's pretty interesting stuff, and it has everything to do with certain families at the top of Anglosphere that become very, very famous. That Red Shield or the Rothschilds, whose name was actually Barr. Bars, yeah, they changed their name to the Red Shield because that was their sign, which is interesting in itself. Yeah, your enemy's sign is always red, period, red. I told you that red hippopotamus, that goes back to the Egyptian mythology, but it's not, it's more cosmic than you think. But anyways, that's a brief overview, and Eustace Mullins, and the student of Ezra Pound, has been instrumental in bringing this stuff out, and he's, when it comes down to historical revisionists, what most of the white nationalists are used to, or what most of the people are used to when they start looking at the total struggle for Europeans, you're dealing with the tip of the iceberg of what's coming down, what has come out, especially since the Internet. When the Internet come out, everything was historical revisions all over the world, but especially when it comes to Europeans. And more people around the world are looking at this stuff than actually white people. Yeah, more people are interested in us than white people are interested in themselves. It's kind of interesting. But I'm going to jump over to Joseph P. Farrell because someone heard number five and number six are probably going to come out about the same time. And I let someone hear number five, and I brought up the Black Sun, and that's very controversial. It's very controversial to start bringing up Black Sun, but let me go into you where this came across my desk. I was having a conversation with someone, and they were talking about the different science topics coming across in Russia, and they were talking about Richard C. Hoagland. Well, Richard C. Hoagland writes all kinds of fantastical stuff about the spaceships and NASA and all kinds of stuff. You know, you can look them up, come to your own opinion, but that's no big deal to me because he didn't talk about race. But then something interesting happened. They talked about the Russians were covering this particular new book by Hoagland and the different topics discussed by Joseph P. Farrell on some different news networks there. And the Russians can put out stuff in a roundabout way. Sometimes you want to put out stuff on Pravda. It sounds ridiculous, but you might want to put it out there just to air it out. For instance, the Russians put out there they're going to ship in all the great farmers from America into the Russian plains and just buy them out. They put that out on Pravda not even a year ago. Why would they put that out? Well, for a variety of different reasons. Who knows? Maybe they're putting out feelers or something. But I'm just giving you an example. There's many different ways to put a message out that isn't directly at all, but yet it is, if you know what you're looking for. So they were talking about this, and I started scratching our heads. What are they talking about? Who's this guy, Joseph P. Farrell? Hogan, we know about. Who's Joseph P. Farrell? And what's he talking about when it comes down to Russian scientists? Well, what he was talking about in regards to pyramid, this is one of the most famous Russian physicists was involved with this pyramid experiment lasting years. I mean, you don't tie up one of your top 10 physicists in some experiment that's something boneheaded. You're certainly not going to tie them up for very long if it's not going anywhere. That's kind of just common sense. If you're researching a weapon system and it's not going anywhere, well, they're going to pull it pretty quickly. If you're researching a weapon system and you're tying up a physicist for a long, long period of time, well, then it's going somewhere, isn't it? That's kind of common sense. And when it comes down to weapons development, especially something like Russia, or science development, something like Russia, we didn't know anything. In fact, we found out most of that when the Berlin Wall came down. When the Berlin Wall came down, they matched together Germany, East Germany, and East Germany was all communist, remember? And they started looking at all these records and everything. But anyways, Joseph P. Farrell dug through all this, and he speaks German. He knows a lot about ancient languages because he has a PhD from Oxford and some type of religious study, some type of theology, believe it or not. So he knows a lot about ancient languages. And what his books were doing, when I looked at it, the first look, I laughed. You know, his hypothesis, he did something interesting, which we hadn't seen when you get into alternative history, you get some far out stuff. It doesn't matter whether it's the New Age stuff, it goes out there. But he did something interesting. He didn't extrapolate a lot of opinions. He's just proposing a hypothesis based on ancient texts and new interpretations based on what we know about where this physics is going now. In other words, well, let me give you an example. I'll give you an example that kind of blew my mind. He was talking about Himmler in the Second World War, and that's what he's big on, historical revisionists from the Second World War. What does that tie into the Great Pyramid? Well, that's a good question. that's where the head scratching began. Joseph P. Farrell started digging in the Second World War. And he started digging into stuff that came out after the reunification, stuff that no one could get their hands on. Since he reads German, he was at a big advantage. And I'm guessing he reads Russian and some ancient languages, too. See, German had the foremost experts on Sumeria. They also had some of the foremost experts even 300 years ago on ancient Egypt. Even reading that, I mean, all kinds of different stuff. The Germans have always been on top of their game. Well, he was looking at World War II, and he's looking at this Himmler's group. And Himmler's group, the Ancestry Research Bureau, you might remember that. They were basically there to document Aryan ancestry going back so long, and he looked at the original charter. And the original charter said, and everyone has noticed this, you know, Himmler sent all these groups all over the world. He sent them to Tibet. Maybe you remember that movie about the Nazis in Tibet. He sent them all over South America looking for stuff. He sent them all over the place. But no one ever really realized why, other than they were looking for these white gods, so to speak. But anyways, he looked at the original charter, and the original charter said, you know, basically, they're here to research Aryan ancestry. But they weren't just limited to five centuries of the Reich or Germany 2,000 years or whatever. They were there open-ended. Aryan ancestry, whether it lead to occult or esoteric means, which is kind of famous in Hellboy, you know, the beginning of Hellboy where you have Himmler's research bureau out there doing all kinds of weird occult stuff. But also, there was another clause, and it's potential weaponization. And the weapon potentials. And then there was a, you know, I don't know the exact phrase in German, but what they were doing is rereading ancient texts in a modern theme. They were rereading ancient texts in a way that we just can't we just couldn't get it through our heads. They weren't reading them as in, you know, this or that. They were reading them. They weren't reading them under what you see is what you get philosophy. They were reading it as a topological metaphor. In other words, they realized that there was an integration, a high civilization, and everyone's heard of this, Atlantis. There's been called many names, a super high civilization that existed, some say 200,000 years ago. I don't know. I have no idea. But they thought it was serious. Many of you understand that. It doesn't matter what we believe. They were dead serious. But they were reading this stuff as a topological metaphor for a very advanced science. And they were interested in that science. But they also knew that there was a total integration between science, philosophy, and religion. So if you're laying out a religious document, if you're laying out a philosophy, well, then there must be a science involved in that as well. And that's what they were doing. And they were doing it in regards to the black sun. Now, where does the black sun come from? Well, if you look in Sumeria legend, I believe it is Marduk is very upset over the destruction of Sumeria. Don't know how long ago this was. It may have been 50,000 years ago. Maybe it never happened. Whatever. They believed it did. And he was upset over that. And the goddess, I think it was Ishtar, said, don't worry that there is a light emanating. And that light will awaken a new Sumer in the future. And all this other stuff. But they extrapolated a science from that. And that's where this topic of the black sun comes from. That the light will yet again awaken. And this whole entire concept. But it was not just philosophy. They were laying it down as they believed they were laying it down like some kind of topological metaphor for them to find later or something along those lines. And then, of course, you have the what I call the obvious. The what you see is what you get type stuff. Yes, they were reading it like a topological a metaphor, and nothing is more obvious when you read something like the Rig Veda. We think in terms of this happened at the Rig Veda was laid down 2000 BC, and it talks about some big warfare, and the Aryans came in there and crushed everything. Well, we don't know when that really happened. All we know is that the Hinduism was started then. Well, Hinduism was a mystery religion laid down from something probably previous. We don't know how long ago this war happened, but let me give you an example of what they were reading, and you can consider it for yourself. Victorious with the man hero in battles, thy bolt thou castest at the foe. Trample them down beneath thy foot. A conqueror scatterer art thou. Thou conquerest, boundest many tribes forever. Like castles thou hast crushed the godless races and bowed the godless scorner's deadly weapon. You know, what type of weapon is that? I don't know. Well, listen to this. Thou hurlest forth from heaven the iron missile. Thou hurlest forth from heaven the iron missile. Bolt armed, ere darkness overtook the sunlight. Thou castest at the veiling cloud thy weapon. All our enemies who near or far away prevail against us, crush and leave them destitute. Against them send thy fiercest flaming weapon. Rend them from other, crush them and subdue them. And then the Rig Veda goes into all this other stuff. But this talk about this ancient war, and when we're talking ancient war, we're talking ancient. Joseph P. Farrell went into that in Cosmic War. Got a lot of attention. That guy has to, I don't know... he has to be watched night and day because he's talking about stuff that when you talk about Europeans, it usually gets attention because this stuff has been pretty much underground, I'm guessing, since World War II. But this type of thing in the Rig Veda was used in colonialism, that wordism. Yeah, they went and conquered India. But when you actually read the text, when you read it, when you read the Sumerian text, it's called the creation myth, the Enuma Elish. Well, there's only a certain portion that's creation. A lot of it sounds like outright war, and they're not talking about little weapons. I mean, what in 2000 BC they're talking about Indra slamming an iron missile? You heard it yourself. You can look it up. Thou hurlest forth from heaven the iron missile. Well, they're not talking about little arrows. They're talking about destroying whole cities. They're talking about some pretty wild stuff. Well, we might look at that and say, yeah, whatever, what does that do for us? But the National Socialists didn't really do that. They said, of course, we're byproducts of these gods. They came to this planet and whatever, and we're going to figure out their weapon system, and we're going to start doing that. And lo and behold, they started firing missiles on London, firing a lot of missiles on London, and building bigger missiles. Yes, but where'd they get this at? Well, they got it from ancient texts, and which is kind of interesting. But you're dealing with the total integration between science, philosophy, and religion. And when I say science, even biology. Science includes biology, of course. But I can give you another example of this. The swastika. Most everyone listening to this has seen the swastika. Well, the swastika would not only have a religious meaning, it would have a philosophical meaning, and it would have a scientific meaning. Yes, this type of physics. This type of physics they were that they've talked about that the Nazis were trying to develop or did develop. We don't really know, having to do with the Glock or the Bell. Very fascinating stuff about two rotating cylinders, two rotating and which was totally cosmic to them. You remember they talked about man and anti-man. The Aryan was man and the Hebrew was anti-man. They were spinning off of each other in this world egg. Well, that's what the swastika is. It's two of these Anglican crosses spinning off of each other in motion. And of course that would be the scientific part of it. But the Glock or the DeBell was dealing with this, and he's talking about this, and Joseph P. Farrell kicks this out, and they're talking about it on Russian TV. And of course it comes to my attention, you know, what is this stuff about? And I said, I have no idea. I thought, you know, these guys are usually just bonehead researchers who are putting out these wild different theories or hypotheses about faces on Mars. Well, what are they talking about? I mean, Mars, when it comes to our race, nothing is more wild than Mars, because, you know, everyone talks about Mars and the Mars and the planet of war, the red planet. But anyways, that's another topic for another day. But what are they going with this stuff? You know, he comes out with you know, all this stuff about the pyramid structure, and he's not talking about just boneheaded hypothesis. He's talking about scientific research out of the Soviet Union that's even on Russian TV. And now you're talking about cross references between him and Hoagland, and now you're talking about he kicks out a book called Reich of the Black Sun. And Reich of the Black Sun is like, I didn't know what to think of it when I first read that thing. And then next thing you know, he just recently kicked out Nazi International. But this is a type of historical revisionist going on in World War II that has nothing to do with the Holocaust, which is the one that gets all the attention, which is interesting, isn't it? The Holocaust revisionists get a lot of attention for good reason. They're getting thrown in jail. Yeah, what's my opinion on that? My opinion would be the same as anyone on bugs. I mean, anytime you have a historical fact that's illegal to dispute, and I don't care what king, potentate, nation, or even what it was, whether it's a flat earth, if it's illegal to dispute it, eventually someone's going to find something wrong with it, and something's going to be wrong with it. Or in other words, as Bob would say, it's always turned out to be a lie. Now, does that mean I'm saying Holocaust? No. You know, obviously a lot of Jews died. If they say 6 million, I'll say 6 million. I'm not going to go to jail. I don't know. I usually give people respect when it comes to their dead ancestors, but when you're throwing people in jail for questioning it, it doesn't really matter what some European thinks. It doesn't really matter what we're only 10% of the planet. The rest of the world looks at this and like, well, there's obviously something wrong with it if you're throwing people in. If an open and free society is throwing people in jail for discussing it, you know, it looks a little weird. Well, the Muslims are saying something. You know, it's what you see is what you get. That's my philosophy on that. But when it comes to World War II revisionism, that's not the stuff going on that's getting attention. That's kind of like a little ethnic conflict model. You know, you got these guys that come out with their revisionist history for good reason. All history is getting revised right now, especially since the invention of the internet. It accelerated because people are talking to each other that have never talked to each other. You know, historians are meeting online and sharing facts. Joseph P. Farrell, I'm guessing, is getting past all kinds of stuff, because you don't put out books like Nazi International. You just don't put that stuff out. That stuff gets out because someone wants it out. I'll give you another example. Shark Hunter. Shark Hunter is an organization that is controversial. It's controversial, but it's not. Most of you have never heard of it, but yet Ronald Reagan belonged to it. It's got about 8,000 members, and it's a who's who of Navy, who's who of politicos all across the Western world and Japan. Yeah, I mean, there's admirals in the U.S. Navy that are members. They put out something called KTB once a month, and they are doing nothing but World War II revisionism. I'm talking about total revisionism of World War II, and they're not even touching the Holocaust, and that's probably why you never heard of them. But they don't have to if you're kicking out the type of revisionism. I got their latest book sitting. It was a book based on a letter that Harry Cooper, who runs a place, got on his desk. And what is the book called? The book's called Escape from the Bunker. It's a letter from Don Angel, who was a famous, I guess, Spanish spy to Harry Cooper in 1984. When was this released? 2006. You want to talk about wild revisionism. Now, I don't know what to make of all of it. I'm just passing it along. But that's you know, when you got stuff coming out, and, oh, is there a tie between Joseph P. Farrell and Shark Hunters? Yeah, he's a member. You know, you got to connect the dots with this stuff. But they're putting out some stuff. They're putting it out there for people. If you know where to look, it's getting a lot of attention. How much attention is it getting? Well, our enemy's in such panic that they went into a UFW hall in Florida just a few months back and started harassing some old men that were members of Shark Hunters. Yeah, there's like a major place they hang out at in Florida, like a UFW hall. You know, these old veterans that are members of Shark Hunters. And Shark Hunters actually specializes in documenting U-boat history, German U-boat history. They're the foremost experts on German U-boat history. In fact, they actually have a whole they have something to do with the actual historical museum in Germany. But what they are is World War II historians, and they're putting stuff out in a roundabout way. I've never seen anything like it. And we're not talking about just boneheaded members. You're talking about like Ronald Reagan was a member. Well, if Ronald Reagan's a member, you got yourself an international recognized group on some level. ATF raided them and harassed them for some kind of saying they were playing cards for money or something like that. It didn't go anywhere. But when you see stuff like that happening, that's pretty desperate action. That's pretty desperate action. But they put out a book in 2006 that's got some attention. You never heard about it, but I sure did. I sure did, because you started talking about how Adolf Hitler and Martin Bormann escaped from the actual spy Don Angel Alcazar Del Velasco from 1984, a letter you got in 1984. You're putting some stuff out there, aren't you? Yeah, it's interesting stuff. Is it true? I don't know. But there's always a connection between this thread of info coming in. And most of you are unaware of it. Most of you are totally unaware of it. It's kind of tragic. But and at the same time, it's not like something you're going to see advertised on TV. It was on Russian TV. Yeah, these guys are making Russian TV. The Russians are more interested in stuff than us. But it doesn't matter whether it's Eustace Mullins, a student of Ezra Pound, or the stuff coming out of Shark Hunters, or Joseph P. Farrell was putting out some off-the-wall stuff. But if you're backing it up in documents, you know, he gave the actual documentation for Himmler's SS group and talking about what they were really doing. Because everyone's seen this. Everyone saw them running across the world. But what are they doing with that? And connecting things like the Reg Veda or, you know, 50,000-year-old Sumerian history or something like that with a modern-day weapon system based on a total integrated science. It's pretty out-there stuff. But at the same time, that's the direction the stuff goes. It goes out there. Connecting something in World War II all the way back like that, talking about where they're going with this stuff is well, it's historical revisionism. It is what it is. But that's a good example of our history and how much we don't know. I have no idea. But I've read this stuff, and it is controversial. Because anytime, you know, he is a theological, he specializes in the first 1,000 years of Christianity and the early church fathers. And when you start talking about a total integration of philosophy, science, and religion, it's going to buck up against a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, you're dealing with overturning. If you say the Enuma Elish, which is basically what the creation story of the Bible was based on, it's an integrated version, basically a shortened version. But the Enuma Elish only has a handful of verses dealing with creation. The rest is about a huge war, in his opinion. That's Joseph P. Farrell's hypothesis. But if you read it like a European, if you start reading Indra, if you start reading about the Reg Veda, well, you can come to some different conclusions. When you look at our modern weapon system, you can come to some different conclusions. When you get this stuff coming out of World War II and what they were doing and what happened after that, like Nazi International deals with, or Reich of the Black Sun, or even Hoagland's book on NASA, most of you don't know this, but most of the NASA landings on the moon happened at precise dates, like Hitler's birthday. Most of you don't know that. Yeah, so what's really going on? I don't know. I'm just simply pointing you in a direction. I have no idea. But that's the direction stuff goes. It is wide sky. Obviously, if a book's coming out called Escape from the Bunker, written by a former spy for Germany, that checks out. Apparently, he checks out as a former spy for Germany, but a Spanish spy, about Hitler and Bormann escaping from the bunker in 2006, you'd think that makes some news. It did in some circles in Germany. It did in Russia. You know, if Joseph P. Farrell writes a book, Nazi International, you'd think something like that makes some news. I mean, he's putting out historical documents. I'll give you the most famous historical document he did. I've never seen this done. In World War II, you have surrender documents. The surrender documents from the Japanese are totally complete. He translates them. He gets them translated in English, and he shows what they look like. Everyone and their brother, from the emperor on down to all the different generals and whatever, the major different factions of the army and the political apparatus, surrendered. They all signed it. When it comes down to the Nazi documents, well, there's some holes missing. Yeah, there's some big holes. That party never actually surrendered. I mean, you can get the book, you can read the documents for yourself. Now, does that mean they didn't? I don't know what happened. No one knows what happened. But they didn't. I mean, it's not there. There's whole segments missing. You can read it for yourself and form your own conclusion. But the evidence that he presents in actual documentation becomes overwhelming at a certain point in time. Now, what does that mean for us? I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. When you say all hope is lost, one of the challenges for Europeans is we tend to, actually people period, rabbits period. We have our peer group. You see all the people around you. Maybe you see your fellow white nationals. Maybe you see your fellow Stormfront or Bugs or whatever. You have the person at your job that's your peer level. You think alike. You read the same literature and whatever. You see all the stupid animals, the sheeple, a mile behind you. You see millions of them, don't you? That's obvious. That's what you see is what you can get. But what you don't see is that under natural law, for every stupid animal you have a mile in front of you, for every 1,000 stupid animals you have a mile behind you, you must have one very bright white rabbit a mile ahead of you. That's natural law, isn't it? There's always someone smarter. There's always someone faster. And all I can do is send you down a particular channel of info and to get your head out of your tail and start reading what your enemy's reading, because your enemy's panicking. They've been panicking since 2007 in a way you can't imagine, because they had to have their stuff done and it's falling apart. The people running Anglosphere are panicking. They're acting very irrational. They're going after every target they can find. And I'm going to talk about that a little more when I talk about Mr. Burr. I don't know if I got James Van Braun or Braun or whatever his name is that shot up the Holocaust Museum. I'm going to go into that. So when it comes down to our history, everything's wide sky. Everything's under revision. And right now, everything you know is up for grabs. In fact, the less you realize it, the more it is up for grabs. I realize that everything I knew or I thought I knew becomes up for grabs. When you have groups like Shark Hunters putting out what they put out, I mean, all you have to do is go to their website and look at their membership list. You're not dealing with stupid animals. You're dealing with someone putting out a message that someone is looking to put out a message and put it out very broadly in front of your face. I mean, they're putting stuff right in front of people's faces in those KTB reports every month. So much so that our enemy is panicked. They've been panicking a lot since 2006, like no one's ever seen, acting like irrational wild animals. You start walking into UFW halls with an ATF, harassing people, that's getting desperate. That's getting very desperate. But that's the state of our history. When you deal with Eustace Mullins or the stuff Mr. Farrell's putting out, you're going in some wild directions. But that's where it goes. And this is type of stuff that is wide sky. I'm usually not aware of it until someone points me in that direction. And when it comes down to, I'll go into a modern event and how something happened right in front of your face and my face, and I didn't really even see it, but something's obviously going on there. What happened with the what happened in South Africa with the Zulus and the Boer farmers? The Zulu, Jacob Zuma, was up for election, and Jacob Zuma was going to have a big problem getting elected because Mbeki, the good rabbit, bad rabbit, or as I say, the bad rabbit, evil rabbit, Mbeki and Mandela, they don't like him. They don't trust him. You see, it goes back a long ways. I don't personally care. I don't know enough about him. You know, he's always saying kill the white farmer like everyone else. And, you know, if you're a Boer, you're thinking about getting out of there, you're probably, that'd probably still be a good ideal. But anyways, Jacob Zuma's trying to come into power. And he kept on having these behind-the-door closed meetings with the Boers. A lot of behind-the-door closed meetings. A lot of them. A lot of them, a lot of them, a lot of them. The Zulus are meeting with the Boers. What's he trying to do? What's going on here? What am I missing? And you know, I get a phone call. It's like, well, what's going on with the Boers? They get themselves a homeland. They get a deal. They cut a deal with the Zulus. You know, Zulus want Zulu land and Boers want Boer land. And I said, Jacob Zuma is a wild card. I don't know anything about him. I just assume he's an enemy. And Botha, he was meeting with Botha, and Botha's always been a traitor. But anyways, I don't know anything. So then I start looking into it, and they start doing several more meetings. The more meetings they're doing, they're behind the door meetings. And the next thing you know, I see some parties in this case in London panicking. I mean, panicking. Our enemy basically started panicking, and you get this back channel feedback, and they're panicking. They're panicking in different press communications. They're panicking about this election and Jacob Zuma. They keep panicking, and anytime, obviously, if your enemy's panicking, it must be something good for you, right? Maybe not tomorrow morning, maybe not next year, but something good happened. And so then we're talking about this, and I'm like, you know, something had to happen there, and I'm assuming something did. Very wide sky, what you don't see type of scenario. Mandela and Mubeki were owned by a different group. Mandela's statue is in London. That should tell you something. I think he's the only African who has himself a statue in London. That should tell you a whole lot. He came up and he was the good cop, and then Mubeki came in there and he started asymmetrically attacking the Boers, because that's what our enemy does. They bought into this second generation communism, this blended humanity that the people running Anglosphere wanted. Certain groups want it, Protestant and Hebrew alike. And he bought into that, and he played that bad rabbit role very well. They both did. But one of them was pretty nice, and the other one was positively evil. Had the appearance of being nice, but one of them was, you know, Mandela was bad, the other's just evil. And he asymmetrically attacked the Boers, and he did so through immigration, because that's how they do things. They asymmetrically attack. They don't fight up. If he'd square up with the Boers and fight him, he'd lose. He's not going to do that. But he's asymmetrically attacking them through immigrations, through open borders. And that's what they're doing. You know, people are coming in there going wild and whatever. Most of the attacks against the Boers are through illegal immigrants or from squatter groups caught in Zimbabwe or whatever. But he's been doing this. But apparently there was a problem in doing that. You see, if you're asymmetrically attacking a Boer minority, which is at 10%, well, guess who else you're attacking? You're attacking a lot of Zulus. Yeah, I mean, if the Boers aren't safe, well, no one's safe. And that's just, I guess that's just common sense. And I never really thought of that angle. Well, the Zulus, the Zulus aren't interested in being anything but Zulus. And the Zulus don't particularly like the Xhosa, or they don't like some of the Xhosas in charge. They especially don't like the Mandelas or the Mubekis, because they're generally traitors to the Xhosa. And that's you know, our enemy owns all traitors. They're interested in this blended humanity. They're interested in killing everything or whatever. You know, they're basically pink rabbits. They are sellouts. But Jacob Zuma, I was asked a question about him. I know something about his background. I know that he wasn't educated. He wasn't educated in the West, which means he wasn't miseducated. He was educated a Zulu. I also know that his handlers were Soviet. They were old, hardline Soviet, not Anglosphere, not second generation commie, first generation commie. He has a totally different set of handlers. He's educated a Zulu, and he has Soviet style operating procedures, operating tactics, which are very good. I also know that Mubeki has always accused him. You know, he's always watered up to Mandela. Mandela's apparently a pretty social, nice guy, very easy to nosy up to. But at the same time, Mubeki's never trust him. He's always told Mandela that he's an actor. You know, he's accused Jacob Zuma for a decade and a half or 2 decades of being an actor, saying, you're not really with us, you're just an actor. You're an actor. You know, you're just going through the motion. You're not here for this. You know, in other words, he's not really buying into all this. You're still a Zulu. Well, if it comes down to selling out his Zulus, it ain't going to happen. And I'm assuming something along those lines happened. But anyways, Jacob Zuma came to power, and then all of a sudden you have even more backdoor meetings. And I'm like, what's going on? What are they setting up on down the road? And you have total panic at the disco. Panic at the disco is when our enemies are just huffing and puffing. You got Mubeki saying, I told you so. I don't know, what, I told you so what? I told you, he's basically saying that, you know, I told you this guy's just an actor. He's not really with us. Well, something happened there. Now, I don't know exactly what, but I'm assuming that for him to secure any of his critical points long term, well, he can't really do a deal with the Zosa, and he doesn't need them for anything. Oh, but you have some potential white tigers there. They could, in fact, the Boers right now could take down the whole place. It would be ugly. They'd go out Valhalla style. You'd read about it, but they could take the place down. They could monkey wrench the place down. They could do whatever they wanted to do if they chose to exercise power. But you see, the Zulus can't get anything they want by dealing with any of the African tribes necessarily. But they don't have to. All they have to do is cut a deal with the Boers. They don't have a problem with the Boers. Yeah, the Boers had that African misfortune. The Boers had this famous African misfortune. They found themselves a diamond mine and some gold mines. The next thing you know, all those pink rabbits from London came running in there and said, well, that's not your gold mine. That's not your diamond mine. That's now mine. Yeah, my name's Oppenheimer. That's mine. Yeah, you got to share that with us. That's okay. That's how that works. But that's what they said. They said those Boers had an African misfortune just like us, and we want Zulu land. We don't like this open borders. We don't like this chaos. We liked it better when we had a good partnership, and they did what they do best, and they did what. And then he walked in Orania. Orania is this little colony of Boers that has always been written off and everything else. But you know, when you have someone like Jacob Zuma walking in there and saying that the Zulus are going to try to learn from this and learn how to be as self-sufficient as possible so they can set up Zululand. When they're making these statements, well, something's going on there. But you see, he can't make a move. He can't do anything unless he cuts a deal with someone. Well, who's his natural ally? Well, Zululand has nothing to do with Boerland. They're totally, I mean, they're in the same territory. They're in South Africa, but they're not. They're not overlapping each other. There's no conflict there, necessarily. They've lived together for hundreds of years without really a whole lot of conflict. Well, he's got to do a deal with someone. And so, interesting enough, he's done something. And I'm not saying that your friend who's a Boer farmer shouldn't get out of there tomorrow morning. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying something's happened, and that's the way this stuff has been working. It's totally blindsiding people how fast this is coming up, how fast things are happening and setting up. What are they setting up? I'm not fully sure. I mean, I know the direction. But anyways, for him to get what he wants, he has to give someone else what he wants. And the Boers were totally blown away. The Boers were like, all hope is lost. We might as well just put our tombstones up, get ready for the Valhalla moment, and try to get out of here, or continue to get out of here. They couldn't believe that the Zulus would even think about doing a deal with them. Well, they have power. You're forgetting that you have power. People always want to do deals with someone with a lot of power. And maybe his Soviet handlers had Zuma there for 20 years ago for a particular reason today. Maybe 15 years ago they put him there. Well, that's basically what Mbeki was alluding to all along, that he's a plant, he's an undercover lover. He's there to do something at a certain point in the future. Was Botha like that too? Was he just a traitor under disguise? I don't know. I mean, you'd think he was, but that's how this stuff has been operating. And it is blindsiding people, and our enemy is getting very, very frustrated because they don't know who's their enemy. And that's how things are working for us now. It's kind of funny, but at the same time, it's very frustrating if you're the average white guy looking at this trying to figure out what on earth is going on. It's frustrating for me, too, because I'm getting good info, but I only know something happened, and something is happening there. But you see, that's how things are going to work. Basically, these two sides are squaring off. One of them visually is a lot of, you could say it's a lot of Hebrews. Visually, that's what you see, but there's a lot of Protestants there too. You got the Jimmy Carters, you got all that, and they're at the top of Anglosphere. And the Anglo-Banking is squaring off for their New World Order, but they've had the rug jerked out from underneath them, slowly but surely, since 1998. I mean, they've been getting crushed. They have been getting crushed, piece by piece. And a big piece has been lost just recently. in regard to all their different banking stuff. Because if they didn't have it all together and rolled out by late 2007, they were in trouble for a variety of different reasons. I'm not going to go into that, but that was their thinking at least. And the CSB are right, because they're panicking. They're acting very irrationally. Then you have another side. Who's the other side of the equation? Well, who do you think it is? Who do you think it is? It's a wide mirage of Europeans, but behind it sits what I label the third power. And that's something that's there. It's there, it ain't moving, and who knows what they have. Who knows what they've been up to, because they are wide sky. They are completely wide sky. You know, when you read that book, when you read the stuff coming out of Shark Hunters, or you read that Nazi International, read it. Read it. Open up your head. Open up your eyes. But they're playing for some long-term game. They're playing for something. They're playing for who's going to roll out the next level of technology and the type of technology that they have, that our race has its hands on right now. From what I've seen and heard, and these aren't from stupid animals. It makes a neutron bomb look like a it makes your average hydrogen bomb look like a Roman candle. Yeah, we're dealing with some heavy-duty stuff here, so they're playing a very big game, and they're playing for keeps, apparently, and one side is on the ropes. One side has to have a coalition. They always have to get the Indians involved or try to get the Chinese involved, but they don't really want to deal with them either. They're more interested in joining the other side. That's what's funny about it. And I may touch on this some more in the future, but the other side is just homogenous, with a single vision of the past and single vision of the future, and they're going for something here long term. They've been going for it a long time, and that's what you're into. You're coming into an end game, and someone is panicking, and that's good. It's good. It's good to have an enemy panicking, and when you get into something like. Something that just happened, and I'm going to touch on this, is James von Braun. It's almost a stereotypical type of thing. Here's a man that actually, I was actually surprised, he walks in and shoots up a Holocaust museum. Well, Chairman Mao's not going to shoot up a Holocaust museum because they don't have any power. That's a waste. But you're dealing with a common sense of oppression among non-victims, and you're dealing with a guy that has a terminal illness, and he's going after his enemy. It's almost like he almost fell into a classic conflict model, didn't he? And he went after an object of that. He went after your local Holocaust museum. Well, that's shooting a black security guard, he doesn't have any power. It's from a revolutionary act. By the way, you're not a revolutionary, period, unless you cause a revolution and win. Then you can say whatever you want. Until then, you're just going to be a terrorist, especially if you're committing any act of violence. But I scratch my head over this, because here you have a pretty bright guy. I've seen the book he wrote. I looked that up just 2 days ago. I looked up the book. This is a pretty articulate fellow. He's got a terminal illness. He's going to go after someone. I mean, he's a white tiger. A very dangerous situation for the system. He could monkey wrench something. He could go after someone with a lot of power, but he went after. It's almost like someone put a chip in his head. I always say this in regard to Abe Foxy Foxman. They're just stereotypes. What we're seeing here are stereotypes. It's very weird stuff. But you're not a revolutionary until you cause a revolution. And you better understand something. Sherman Miles is not going to be shooting security guards. That's a waste of time. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. This guy was intelligent. He fell for, what it looks like to me, he fell for a classic conflict model. He went after an object. You know, it's like these Africans used to shoot up everything and say, yo, you know, white people are an object of our oppression. Well, they don't have any power. If you're going to jail for shooting someone white, without any power, you know, that's stupid. On the other hand, if you go around shooting federal, if that African that's spraying a gun at me is going around shooting federal judges that are white, well, that's a different story, isn't it? You call yourself a revolutionary, guess why you sit in jail. But you're not a revolutionary until you cause a revolution. Our enemy is really only afraid of large monkey wrenching. And we can say this because the Pentagon has put out these reports. They're afraid of large monkey wrenching. In other words, someone shutting something down, which is what they're afraid of, because they'll lose money and they'll lose control. They're also afraid of something like James von Braun going into probably some kind of big meeting among some big boss people or something, you know. But they're not afraid of someone shooting up a Holocaust museum. They're just going to use that energy to shove something down your throat. And that's what they've been doing. They've been ATF is all over the place among white nationalists and anyone who's ever advocated any type of violent act at all, whether it be Hal Turner or Tom Metzger. They're going to be all over it. If they haven't already, they will be, because that's what they do. They're going to try to use that energy to do something, but they are grabbing at straws because these guys are very visual. They've been out there. They don't know where their enemy's at. They know where portions of it are at, but it is all wide sky. It's kind of funny to see how this comes about, and also tragic. If you make yourself a target for that old owl, that is their symbol, an owl. An owl sees best in the dark. An owl has to turn its head to see, though. Yeah, an owl can't turn its eyes, but once it locks onto you, it has to commit. There's a lot in their symbolism. They always use an owl. Yeah, they use an owl all over the place, but that they gotta commit once they lock on, and they will keep after you. But they are desperate. When you have UFW halls being raided, when you have stuff like this happen, and they are desperately going after people, it is what someone does when they're panicking across the board. And the stuff behind the lines, behind the scenes, is also panic. They're in negotiation with people. They've been negotiating on stuff for 2 decades, but they don't have anything left to negotiate on now. They're in trouble. So don't make yourself a stupid target. I mean, you can't call yourself a revolutionary and worry about a Holocaust museum. They're also, let me tell you one thing they're worried about. They're worried about a consistent message. They're worried about it. They know that you have a common sense of oppression among non-victims. They've tried to look at how to use that to take out Islam. But the neocons don't know how to do it without getting themselves plowed over, because it's been so bent. They're at the forefront of all the anti-racist stuff. The Hebrews have been at the forefront of non-European immigration and Anglosphere. So how do you bring that out? How do you use this weapon against Islam? Any other time, they would just make it racial and plow Islam under, right? Well, they can't go there anymore. Or they have a feeling they can't go there, because what does it mean for them? That's an interesting point, isn't it? What does it mean for them if they try to go racial? Well, they just can't do it. They can't do it post-World War II. They've drawn a line in the sand, so it's like it's a very weird situation. When you have a common sense impression among non-victims, and someone can articulate that, like I do in talking points, or like Bob does with the mantra, over and over again, they're worried about that. They're worried about something dropping and someone getting a tribunal together and getting them off the street really quickly. That can happen. They're worried about that. Probably much more so than they worry about a big hit on a Fortune 500 company or a bunch of CEOs getting killed. You can kill a bunch of CEOs and it'd still be okay. It hurt. It depends on which ones. But I'm just saying that revolutionary acts, that they are worried about a consistent message that articulates that, because they lose power. If you have a consistent message that is working, it doesn't matter whether it's Obama, oh yes we can, the Republicans immediately start losing energy. And of course, losing power first starts with the loss of an energy flow. And we can dominate the energy flow when it comes to this common sense of oppression among non-victims. We can dominate that energy flow, but it has to start with a consistent message. They are worried about that. They are afraid of that. That's why you haven't heard about someone like Bob Whitaker. They don't want you to know we exist. They don't want that. The reason you haven't heard about Shark Hunters or that book they put out in 2000 exists, because they don't want you to know something like that exists. They want you thinking all hope is lost. They want you with your head up your tail. That's what they want, and that's very useful. Here it is. It's useful. It's easy to put people in a consensus trance. I went over demoralization. Most of you have no idea what I told you. I didn't know about demoralization. I had to understand it 2 and 3 times and see it work. It is profound. A consensus trance is profound. But when you go into a group that's been put in a consensus trance by reading the same information, it doesn't matter whether it's white nationalists or whatever. You have to get them out of that. But you're looking for one particular scenario. Those scenarios aren't working. What's going to work right now is a consistent message. Now, I'm not saying if someone went after a high-profile targets or whatever, who knows? I mean, you got a loaded weapon, but I'm not that bill of goods. You're way too overread in that type of thing. A common sense of oppression can be pointed out to in other ways that can be way more damaging to this type of system, because it's what they fear most. They fear it the most for one particular reason. There is no defense against these type of tactics. There's no defense against those talking points I'm giving you. There's no defense against that. Once you pinprick it and once you get the conversation started, we're going to control and dominate the energy flow. Then you can backdoor whatever you want. There's nothing you can't do with a gun that I can't do with a velvet rope in a tribunal. Yeah, I don't have to break any laws. But that's the game now. The game is not Wild Wild West. But I don't know what's going on with these guys thinking they're going to shoot up a Holocaust museum and cause a revolution. They don't have any power. I mean, say what you want to about Timothy McVeigh, but taking out government buildings, it was bad timing, in my opinion. It was crazy. It was maniacal. Whatever. It was an act of terror because it didn't cause a revolution. But he did. It was a government building. Taking out the Twin Towers. You know, people say that was a cowardly act. Well, that's pretty ballsy stuff. Taking out World Trade Center in a plane is pretty. I mean, that's heavy duty. It didn't cause a revolution here, but it certainly did deliver a war against someone at someone's doorstep. There can be no doubt about that. But I'm giving you an example. Those are very big scenarios. But running around shooting at security guards, or getting yourself busted for doing something stupid, or saying something when there's, or even just debating, not saying 6 million when it comes to the Jews and going to jail in Germany. You know, we have enough Mandelas. We have enough political prisoners. Don't make yourself a target. Don't get thrown in jail for doing anything stupid. And by no means you're not in a violent type of revolution. But what baffles me about Mr. Von Braun is he knew everything I just said. I mean, he's a smart enough guy to know that. That's what they worry about. They worry about someone like that going after high-profile targets and killing them or something, or shutting things down. And, again, they're worried about what they can't stop. They can stop that. They could use that energy time and time again to their advantage, and that's what they're doing right now, aren't they? Sure, they don't care about stopping them from killing Holocaust security guards. They don't care. That's wonderful. He's dead, and we're going to use that to try to get all our stuff in. But what they do care about is someone being on a consistent message that is grabbing a dominant energy flow that everyone knows is there. The Muslims know it's there. Everyone knows it's there. Everyone's waiting for someone to grab a hold of it and do something with it. They got everyone looking for violent scenarios when, in fact, that isn't how this type of thing is brought down. The Berlin Wall wasn't brought down through bullets. It was brought down through a consistent message, believe it or not. And some behind-the-doors wrangling. Yeah, there's a lot of behind-the-doors wrangling right there. But that's important for you to understand that. They do fear that. I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you they don't. Obviously, if the Pentagon's putting out reports about monkey wrenching or about high-profile hits or something like that by lone wolves, well, obviously they're concerned about it. They're not concerned about Holocaust. They're not concerned about the average white kid getting shot by. They're not concerned about that. That's an ethnic conflict model. That can go all day. You're shooting at an object. You're not shooting at anything with any power. Of course, I'm not the war of the flea, the war of me variety. I'm teaching the basics that are much more deadly to the system. That's a consistent message. A consistent message can take you anywhere you want to go. If the conditions are right, if you have a common sense of oppression. This is weird because you have a common sense of oppression among non-victims. You have everyone trying to figure out how to use this energy, and we know how to use it, don't we? Sure, we can do anything you want to do with it. But you have to first articulate it. It has to first start with a sound or a vibration. Yes, it does. It has to first start with at the basic harmonic level. And that is... That is something I'm going to touch on here as we come into the ending of this particular episode 6. Before I close this off, the sixth MP3, I'd like to talk a little bit more about demoralization. An article came to my attention from Occidental Quarterly, and they're kind of like a think tank for maybe white nationalists or Europeans. I don't have a problem with them or anything else because I figure everything's out there for a reason. Everything to me is always useful. Yeah, people make fun of VDIR, or they make fun of this, I never make fun of anything. Because everything becomes a ladder for little rabbits to climb up on. What I don't like is when people aren't seeing things in front of their face, or when they're not trying to read everything. When it comes down to something like VDIR, a lot of guys say, well, that's not useful. You don't know anything about propaganda. You don't know what you're doing. Everything's useful. everything's useful. There are many ways to put out a message. You could put out a message as something subversive and evil, and it actually attract more people than if you put it out like it was on the History Channel, believe it or not. Sometimes you get an article on VDare that attracts someone, they get on there and they claim anything having to do with our race at all, on any level, way, shape, manner, form, can become useful, even if it's backwards. Sure. Many ways to put out a message, and maybe you guys didn't go to school for that, but there's many ways to put out a message. Believe me, I've been asked time and time again. It's been asked so much that why I'm using a particular different type of language when you talk about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, why I'm using language like red hippopotamus, why are my language so unique? Most of you, everyone you're sitting around on a day-to-day basis has been stigmatized. They've been demoralized over a race issue. When you mention race, or when you mention something that comes out on Amarin, like the color of crime or something, when you mention that, they turn it off, don't they? They tune you out. Yeah, they tune you out. Why? They're demoralized. True information does not mean anything to them. I'm going to come back to this point, but the reason I use a unique verbiage, a unique language, a language all on my own, a language that I just made up, is because, one, I know what I'm doing. You see, if I sit down at a table and I talk about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, it seems harmless. Yeah, it seems totally harmless. They're not turned off by that. Someone on the edge, someone that's reading InfoWars, someone that's looking at trying to figure out what's going on with Europeans, but at the same time is turned off by the language of a storm front or the language of your local white nationalists, because they're still in a demoralized state, I'm drawing down the arms. In other words, they're putting their arms down to listen to something like this. It's pretty unique. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. If you're going to do stuff the same way, you're going to get the same results. Someone like me can get results because I'm not going to do things like you've been doing things. But, you know, if you're a white nationalist and you're listening to this and saying it's cool, well, I already have you. I already have you. You're already in the channel. You're already listening to all your stuff. If you're a War of the Me type, one of those undercover lovers, you're listening to this, well, I already have you. You're already out there. I'm looking for something particular. I'm looking for a Plato, and a Plato is not going to be someone listening to those channels or someone turned off by those channels. But you must use a disarming language if someone has been demoralized under an armed language. In other words, if they're demoralized under race issues, well, you have to talk about it in a unique way. You have to draw them in. Now, I've been told it's positively evil that I'm using animals, because guess what? You've been moralized in regards to animals. Yeah, your little 5-year-old kid, he can't think of killing a white rabbit. He has no problems watching Terminator wipe out people by the thousands, but he has a problem killing a white rabbit. It's kind of funny stuff. Yeah, I've been told that it's evil what I'm doing. Well, that's fine. I know how to get results, but that's why I'm using a particular language for a particular reason. I'm using it to draw people in. Now, if it turns off your average, why don't you just talk about things directly? Because I'm not doing things directly. We're not doing things like you've seen things done before. No, that's already out there. You're already doing that. That's fine, but I have my reasons. I'm trying to lay that out for you in a roundabout way, but it's kind of common sense. If you're at a table and you're trying to talk about the color of crime and this not getting through to anyone, it's because they're demoralized. Well, you can't talk about it that way. You've got to go a different approach. Talking about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe becomes funny because I'm disarming it. I'm making it about animals. And if you had a TV program about killing white people, a lot of people would find that funny. You know, you could watch one of these daytime talk shows like The View or something. I think that's a daytime talk show or a morning talk show. You make fun of white people, even the white people laugh. You start talking about harming little white rabbits, well, no one finds that funny. Yeah, so, you know, you got to take a different approach to this, and most of it comes back to demoralization. You don't understand demoralization. Occidental Quarterly, the guy was talking about that he had a bunch of relatives and he was worried about them racially and everything else, making sure they had enough survival supplies or maybe they needed a household shotgun and they were going to donate the money to make sure he'd defend his family, but they weren't really interested. Well, true information doesn't mean anything to them. The tragedy of the situation of demoralization is that the only way to wake them up is to be on a consistent message and let them respond. In other words, if you're in the area and you're saying, in your opinion, it's racist, you're just saying it because of white, anti-racism is a code word for anti-white, and you're going over your talking points. If most people won't respond to that, they will on a subconscious level later on, but right away they won't respond to that. Some will. Now, if your cousin responds to that, well, you have something there. If he doesn't respond to it, you don't have anything. And it's kind of common sense. But demoralization, the tragedy of the situation of demoralization is you don't realize what's done to you until everything's leveled to the ground. They don't realize it. That's the tragedy of the situation. Yes, they won't realize it until the big boot hits them in the behind. And that is the tragedy of the situation. Most people, I lay it out time and time again. In fact, we're going to break out demoralization and put it on the page. Because it's an important concept. If you understand anything from me, understand brainwashing. They will not get it. The only thing you can do is the basics. Kind of like in Obama, you know, if you say, oh, yes, we can, and then people in your area respond, well, you can only go where the response is. You're wasting your time because maybe the Republicans, maybe they don't like Obama, maybe they're tuned out to the message. You understand that. When it comes down to race issues, it's very similar. It's virtually identical. But except you're dealing with a heavily demoralized population that's coming out, so some are going to respond. But if you're trying to convince someone of something, you don't understand. You don't understand what you're doing. Trying to convince someone is a waste of time. All you can do is stay on a consistent message. If you stay on a consistent message that's written by someone clever and understand how it works, it's devastating. It's devastating because you will get your point across to enough people. You will find those that bond together and then take it seriously. You know, if he would have been this person from Occidental Quarterly would have been at a family reunion and stayed on a consistent message like ours or something similar, whatever. If he got a response and someone warm will respond to that, well, that's someone you could work with. The rest are done. They won't realize until everything's leveled to the ground. Maybe they'll survive. Maybe they won't. Maybe you won't even want them to survive. You know, I mean, you know, every family's got a lot of stupid animals in it. But that is the tragedy of the situation, of demoralization. True information will not mean anything from them. True information will not mean anything until it's done, until it's over with. If they're not getting it through their skulls now, well, it is what it is, isn't it? You just have to understand that. Talking about the color of crime, you don't understand demoralization. You don't understand brainwashing. That works. White nationals eat that stuff up. They put it out there. They put it out on the dinner table for the relatives. Relatives just don't get it. Well, you know, the best thing any person in this struggle understands, if you could learn anything, I don't care what you do, understand demoralization, activity of Mevrouw. If you don't understand that, you don't understand how education works. Maybe you've been reading those color of crime reports every year for 10 years. Maybe you're in a consistent trance, looking to do things a certain way. Well, everyone has a job to do. Everything's useful in front of you. Everyone has a job to do. Everyone has a place and a time. In The Lord of the Rings is something that, it's an old book, but it's an interesting book. It's a good book. They wanted to kill Gollum. Yeah, you remember that little guy Gollum? They wanted to kill Gollum, but that big white wizard wouldn't let him. Now, they said, you don't kill Gollum because he may have a role to play that you don't see yet. You know? And Gollum did have a role to play. At the end of that dark age, he danced into the fire with that ring, didn't he? Yeah, if they would have killed Gollum, they may have never gotten that ring into the fire. But he had a role to play. Everything is useful. Nature doesn't make mistakes, even if it looks like it did. Nature didn't make a mistake with Gollum. He was there for a reason. He was there to dance into the fire with that ring. That's his job, cosmically. On a cosmic level, I don't even think cosmically is a word, but on a cosmic level, that was his job. So don't think something's in front of you. You just have to look for a way to work with it. They looked for a way to work with Gollum. They looked for a way to use his energy to their advantage, for better or worse. And in the end, he danced in the fire with that ring. You need to start thinking in those terms. You're not using your big brains. So we're going to break out demoralization, and you're going to have a 20-minute segment or so on demoralization. You can listen to it 15. Get your white nationalists to listen to it 500 times, for heaven's sakes, because you can't convince people. That's why talking points work. You can't convince people to vote for Obama. You got to hit a consistent message and let them respond, and then talking points, so on and so forth. You're not going to convince people because if that talking point works, they'll do whatever you want to do, right? If you're listening to me and you like what I have to say, well, you're going to listen to more. But if you're responding to a consistent message, you are. I mean, you're there already. But if you're trying to sell someone that can't be sold, well, it's a waste of time. But you have to understand demoralization. You have to understand what you're up against. This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting. which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.